Senate Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness will come to order, Madam Vice Chair.
I always like to do some little readings on our, for either written or for our veterans, written by or written for our veterans. And this little segment is called Survivor Guilt, which I hadn't really thought much about. But survivor guilt is a mental condition that occurs when a person perceives himself or herself to have done wrong or feels guilty because he or she survived a traumatic event. And this particular Oregon veteran, has experienced this, and it's both a positive and a negative force. And much of the depression, drive, devotion, and anxiety comes from survivor guilt. And this person believes it deeply affects other returning combat veterans as well. Physical pain, of course, increases these feelings and exacerbates emotional pain as well. So I thought that it would just be apropos to just bring something else to our attention on what many of our veterans are experiencing. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Colleagues, members of the public, we have, it looks like, six public hearings today. The only one we're going to take out of order is 691, which we're going to move to the head of the calendar so that Senator Gelser can move on to other commitments. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on SB 691, ask the good senator to come up. If she's coming up by herself, I'll ask Mr. Stuckey and Mr. Smith to join her. And whenever you're ready, Madam Senator.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I am the state senator from Senate District 8, which includes Albany and Corvallis, Philomath, Millersburg, Tangent, and unincorporated areas of Linn and Benton County. And I'm pleased that Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Olson will be visiting my district this afternoon on our Human Services Committee field trip that's coming up. Thank you for scheduling a public hearing on Senate Bill 691. It's a bill that probably needs a little bit of work to do what it is intended to do. The problem that we are trying to solve is that under outdated discriminatory policies, individuals that honorably served our nation but were gay or lesbian found themselves discharged from the military, often under circumstances that were considered dishonorable or less than honorable simply on the basis of their sexual orientation. Not only is this something that is deeply hurtful and a shame that people carry with them for a long period of time, but it disqualifies them from important benefits that are available to them at the state and federal level. The federal government is working on this through something that's called the Restore Honor Act that would go back and make sure that these individuals are honored for the work that they've done for our country. At the state level, Senate Bill 691 was intended to ensure that veterans who had less than honorable or dishonorable discharge solely on the basis of their sexual orientation would be eligible for all of the state level benefits for veterans that they would have been eligible for, but for that discharge based on the basis that they were gay or lesbian people. I've been very, very grateful to Mr. Smith. We met the other day and talked about the challenge of sorting through those codes to determine why an individual had been discharged. And we talked a little bit about the ongoing needs of gay, lesbian, bisexual service members and veterans from everything from accessing services to upgrading their discharge status. And I think it will be important to amend this bill to be able to provide a veteran service officer that's able to help with this work to make sure that individuals are receiving access to the benefits to which they should be entitled and that they are receiving our gratitude for their patriotism and their service to our country. One of the things that I've learned in studying for this bill, when I first heard about it, I assumed this was something that would impact veterans from the 90s and 2000s under the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. But what I've learned is those that it most significantly impacts are older veterans, those from World War II, those from Vietnam and the Korean War, who have languished for years not telling anyone about this thing that happened to them. Fortunately, our culture has changed significantly so that we kind of push back against that type of discrimination. But for these veterans, for these retired retirees, I do think that it's important that we reach out to them and make sure that they have access to the financial, medical, mental health, and other services that they should be able to access. And hopefully with that can come an apology from us for the disrespect that was shown to people who so honorably stepped up to serve our country. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions and just want to state again how grateful I am to Cameron for the assistance that he's provided in better understanding the issue and the suggestions that he's made to make this actually work for this group of people.
Thank you, Madam Senator. Do you have a few minutes?
Yes.
Okay. What I'd like to do is go through the other panel members, because as you mentioned, we need to do a little work to get ourselves in line with the federal compliance, which is where we're really going. Not a lot of argument about that. There's plenty of court cases out there. And so I think it'd be best to have the two of them put forward, and then we can kind of see what work would need to be done to proceed forward. So, Mr. Smith, if you would, please.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I really appreciate both meeting with Senator Gelser, but also very well spoken on this issue, what is a lot of complexity behind a very simple change, but appreciate her support for our veterans and their families, and the good bridge for us, I think, from this committee over to Human Services and helping link our two policy efforts. This has been helpful both for us to see how we can better serve an underserved population of gay and lesbian veterans, but also raised a lot of issues in terms of how do we define veterans, who is eligible for benefits, and how do we help those that may not be eligible if they were unfairly processed out of the military. In our definition of veteran, ORS 408.225, we define veteran based on the type of military service, the duration of their service, and also the character of that discharge. And for us, that's defined in rules under honorable conditions. So it would typically be an honorable discharge or a general discharge under honorable conditions. And it really runs the gamut over the history, particularly around gay and lesbian service members, how they would have been processed out of the military, depending on the branch, the era of service. Generally, from our research, a dishonorable discharge would be because of a general court-martial and typically would have had much more aggravating circumstances behind it. But there would have been often scenarios throughout history where solely because of their sexual orientation, gay and lesbian veterans would have received a less than honorable discharge and may not be qualified for state and or federal benefits. The gold standard that we use in terms of paperwork is the DD-214 that veterans get when they process out and separate out from the military that would have that character of discharge and typically a reason for that separation. It would not be apparent from that one document if a discharge was solely because of someone's sexual orientation and would necessitate likely some kind of administrative review process where we would look at the separation paperwork, that we'd look at the service record on hand, that we'd take evidence and statements from the veteran in any other surrounding circumstances to try to make a judgment if it was a determination. We'd have to have some process to say it's not an honorable, it's not a general under honorable, but it would still be eligible for state benefits. Would take some work to stand that up administratively, and when looking at limited resources and trying to get the best bang for those limited resources, there is a process both through all of the service branches to upgrade discharge paperwork. If it's within 15 years, the discharge review boards are that for each service branch. If it's beyond 15 years, the Board for Correction of Military Records. And it's a broader population than just gay and lesbian service members that may have been processed out. You have Vietnam vets that may have had post-traumatic stress and then gotten in trouble with drugs and alcohol and gotten processed out of the military. There's been a streamlined process through those discharge review boards on the Department of Defense to relook at mental health and post-traumatic stress. And similarly, there's been broad latitude currently to upgrade those discharges when they are less than honorable solely because of sexual orientation. We haven't had dedicated capacity, whether through the county VSOs or the statewide veteran service officers, but for limited dollars invested, you could invest in a VSO that would be solely missioned on taking those cases where we think there's a good chance that they can be upgraded from a less than honorable to something that makes them both eligible for state benefits, whether the home loan, the veteran's home, skilled nursing or other state benefits, but also that broad array of federal VA benefits. If we simply stand up an administrative review process, that would only qualify them for the limited state benefits, but not the broad range of VA health care and broader disability benefits. Also brought up a lot of good points in terms of just generally, how do we do better outreach to what is a very quiet quiet minority of our veterans population in terms of the gay and lesbian veterans. But happy to take any questions.
We'll hold questions.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I'm Dave Stuckey. I'm the Deputy Director for the Oregon Military Department. I appreciate this bill coming forward. We're very much in support of this bill. There certainly have been a lot of convoluted and policies that existed in the past. From our standpoint, we certainly want to work with Senator and others on moving this forward. This bill does not prohibit or change the way we're doing business currently right now under existing policies, both in the Army and the Air Force. We recognize that there have been some past problems that existed and policies, but as we move forward, we're looking to help participate and be a part of this process. As Cameron Smith mentioned, in the past, we saw a lot of administrative type actions. Generally, the sexual orientation fell under administrative other than honorable type discharges as opposed to the dishonorable kind. However, from our standpoint, making certain that this fits within the current regulations that exist that govern the Air Guard as well as the Army Guard, we certainly want to be a part of that, and we're in support of this.
Okay, thank you. Before we go to questions, colleagues, I mean, just for the viewing audience to make sure, I mean, we're in an era of which there are federal court cases, there are federal policies, there are federal laws that have changed. I did take some time to speak to the sponsor of the bill so that what we got to do is figure out a process that works. And I think, Madam Senator, you said you're willing to kind of work through with some of these two biggest agencies with the most experience. Are sitting to your left and right. And so at my level, it's trying to figure out, okay, in order to get a fiscal, going to get a revenue and get the thing defined, you know, to comply with all the laws, it's a little harder, I think, as you pointed out. We're going back beyond 15 years. I mean, it's you can look at some documents and say in the last 15 years there's a Section 8, as an example. For the audience, Section 8 is generally administrative discharge for reasons similar to this. And so that makes it a little bit easier. But the whole figuring it out and what is the number of individuals you're going to process and how you're going to do this, as the good director of ODVA said, is a bit daunting, but well within our reach this session. And I would like to then open it up to committee members. I just want to remind everybody, we're now in the 21st century. We have federal laws and so on and so forth, so we're not really debating the merits of federal policy. We're debating the merits of the bill. Are there any questions?
Questions.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Boquist. Senator Gelser, could I just ask, if you would, it refers to dishonorable discharge from armed forces of the United States. Would you define armed forces?
Chair Boquist, Senator Courtney, thank you for the question. We spent some time with legislative counsel talking through that. The definition of armed forces does not, in many places, include the National Guard. In some of the references in the bill, it would include the National Guard. It depended on the benefit and whether it was whether or not the individual was eligible for that based on their service. But that we had a good conversation about the definition of military and veteran the other day, and it's something that I think we need to continue talking about. The intention would be to make sure that we're encompassing everyone, including National Guard.
Okay. The only reason I asked is because, Deputy, you referred to the Air Force and the Army, so immediately I'm thinking Navy, Marines, Coast Guard, but I hadn't even thought of the National Guard. So, but the good Senator has said you are attempting to develop a comprehensive interpretation of armed forces of the United States. I'm not trying to trick anybody. I'm just asking a question. Is that right?
Senator Boquist, Senator Courtney, yes, everybody, the Coast Guard, the Navy, Air Force.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
And just for clarification, we're also including the Merchant Marines, which are in here, too.
Okay.
Which is, the issue here at hand is not whether we agree or disagree with federal law or the policy. The issue at hand is, what is the procedure to encompass all these entities, as you know, Mr. Director, and how would you do that? That's the question to be had before us. And good luck, Madam Senator. I mean, we are all ears, and we will give you further opportunities this session to bring it back. But we do need a solution because, as you pointed, it's not a finished product. We figure out how to implement it at the state level. And with that, I'm going to close, unless you have more comments, Madam Senator?
Nope.
I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 691, go back to the beginning to one of our favorite topics, and open a public hearing on SB 87. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 87 establishes a process to implement veterans' preference in public employment that emphasizes interviews for veteran applicants. It maintains the current civil action for unlawful employment practice, sets an operative date of March 1st, 2016, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. This committee, because it has no new members from the interim and the previous regular session, will recall the work group that met over the interim, and the folks that are on the list to testify today have appeared before on this topic, so it'll jog your memories.
Okay, we're going to start with a panel of three, because that's what I'm seeing here. Cameron Smith, Travis Graves, and Scott Winkles, if you would, please. I'm actually starting with the second panel instead of the first panel, so I'll let you guys go anyway.
Yeah.
Director has priority over everybody else.
So good afternoon again. For the record, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, I am Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And we've briefed several times to this committee on Senate Bill 87 and the preference. Simply wanted to give a high level here today, and then also Ms. Lori Skillman will also get into some of the mechanics of the bill, but also have a lot of testimony behind us. But where I always start on this concept and on veterans' preference is that it comes from a place of strength, that our veterans and our military have a lot to offer in terms of transferable skills and strengths in terms of their leadership, their teamwork, their mission focus, their integrity, that all Oregon employers, public and private, are looking for. But at the same time, it's not a surprise as our military and our veterans transition out of the service that translating those strengths and transferable skills is a challenge when presenting themselves to civilian employers. And now more than ever, with less than 1% serving in uniform, to have that somewhat of a disconnect between our military and our civilian population, that veterans' preference is one important way that public employers recognize the service of our veterans and gives them the best opportunity to present their transferable strengths. Public employers in Oregon have long given employment preference to veterans, but over time, as we've seen different hiring practices change, we have tried to amend the statutes in ways that we now find are not as helpful to veterans as they could be. We've long had the scoring process, more of a civil service test process, where you're adding 5 points for veterans and 10 points for disabled veterans, a very clear process in terms of how that should be applied by public employers. The way that preference applies to public employment hiring through interview and ranking-based processes has been more challenging. In 2011, we tried to address this with the addition of 408.437, which required interviews for all veterans that met minimum qualifications. But in practice, this too has proven disappointing to veterans, much less to public employers. And the way I approach it is, when you get that call back for an interview, you put on your suit and tie, you put on your best outfit, you are in the hunt for that position. But the way that we've structured this mandatory interviews for those that are minimally qualified, they may not be in the hunt and competitive for that merit-based opportunity. And whether they're traveling from farther afield or simply being put through a bureaucratic process where they don't necessarily have that true opportunity to be considered. It also puts the responsibility on the veteran in terms of documenting those transferable skills. And I think also is ill-defined often in those interview processes. So you have different applications depending on the different employer across state agencies, across the cities and counties, not necessarily a clear process that both the veterans know what they're going to get in terms of preference in those interview processes, how the public employers will want to implement it, or how the regulators overseeing that the process was done. What I appreciate most in Senate Bill 87 before us today is that in the interview process, we would ensure that the top five veteran candidates would receive an interview. to make sure that the onus is on the public employers to pull those veterans in, to make sure they have that foot forward to be able to present those transferable skills, not just on paper of the resume, but in person in an interview. It doesn't allow for discretion on those five. Even five have to be interviewed, which is a huge plus, and definitely gets the confusion out of the process. Separately, we know the problem that we are trying to solve is not whether our veterans have the skills and leadership and the abilities to thrive, whether in public or private sector employment. But we need to continue beyond these small targeted efforts on preference for public employment, continue to invest how to coach and guide veterans as they come out, whether through the employment department, the military department, ODVA, how to translate those skills into civilian employment, and then also encouraging both public and private employers to understand those transferable skills. And happy to take any questions after the panel.
We'll hold questions. Scott?
For the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. The League of Oregon Cities is an association that comprises all 242 incorporated cities in the state of Oregon, and I'm appearing in support of Senate Bill 87. You'll hear more testimony on the actual mechanics of the bill, but I was a member of the work group. The process attended just about all of the meetings, and both this time and in the previous session when the interview bill was passed, and I think we've come up with a product that work product that works. And I don't think we're talking about interviews now. I think we're actually talking about a bill that helps veterans get jobs. We've made some additions that I believe make it clearer for employers. We've added definitions that make it easier for employers to implement. Previously, employers, when it said consideration, you would require that the employer would provide consideration in the previous statute. We're not sure what that meant. So we had an employer who would bring in all the veterans who had applied for a position to do a meet and greet with the work group they were interviewing for, and let them ask questions and have conversations with members of the work group. And we felt that was, the employer felt that was good consideration. That gives a competitive leg up. That opinion was not universally held, that met the qualification, even though there certainly the spirit, the intent of that HR manager, that department director, was to assist veterans. I also wanted to provide a little bit of context for the committee about the current employment picture for veterans. Right now, roughly 20% of male veterans are employed in the public sector. Male veterans that are employed in the private sector, or in the public sector. It's about 11% for non-veterans. It goes up even higher. 28% of employed female veterans are employed in the public sector. That drops to 17% for non-females who are employed but non-veterans. Most of my HR members, we've never value. They like to see veterans apply for our positions because, by and large, they understand they need to show up on time, in uniform, safety equipment. They have a sense of mission. They understand public service. And there have been issues in the past, to be certain, but by and large, I think the public sector in Oregon has done an admirable job in attracting veterans to the employment department. I would also, into employment, I'd also point out from our HR directors is the amount that there seems to be a disconnect when somebody separates service, because we hear regularly from HR folks who attend veterans jobs fairs that the individual veteran isn't aware of their veterans' preference rights. And I'm not sure where that communication needs to take place, but it's noticeable, and we hear it year after year from our HR people who have gone out and actively recruited from this group. And like to say, League has never opposed veterans' preference as a bill. We've never stood up and said that the veterans' preference was a bad policy. We've expressed concerns about the implementation of the interview bill, but it's never been something that we have said this. We shouldn't do this. We owe this, and we understand that. And with that, I'm happy to take questions.
Okay, thank you. We'll save it to the end. I guess that leaves you.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, my name is Travis Graves. I'm the Human Resources Director for Multnomah County, and I appreciate having the time to speak with you in support of Senate Bill 87. In Multnomah County, we have long been supportive of hiring and retaining our veterans. As an organization, we have about 6,000 employees, so we are a very large urban public employer. We actually have about 375 self-identified veterans within our organization. In fact, we're working to continue to do better at actually being able to count the number of veterans. We're actually creating data sets to be able to do that, which is going to help us understand this even more thoroughly. But one of the challenges we face in the Portland metropolitan area is we're actually competing with the private sector for many of our positions. And with our civil service processes, they can take longer. So we're always looking at ways of trying to do faster, more efficient, but still getting to the best hire. One of the challenges that the current system creates is by having to interview every veteran with such a high volume of applicants that can create a very large workload for us. For example, over the past 5 years, our number of applicants has doubled. We receive about 27,000 applications a year. I'm going to give you a couple examples of kind of some recruitments where it really becomes difficult. We've opened a entry-level position in our library. With that, we can open that position, and within 3 days, we have over 1,000 applications. So looking through that group and interviewing folks, we don't have a control over who's applying or the number of veterans that we have. Another example that I wanted to share with you is a recent background investigator position where we had a single position opened it up, had about 400 applications. Of that, we had about 34 qualified veterans, and then we also had a number of additional qualified non-veterans. At the end of the day, what we ended up doing is interviewing 34 veterans plus bringing in a number of other folks and had interviewed a total of 69 individuals. That represented about a week and a half worth of interviews that and the way we do our interviews, generally, we will have a panel of individuals. So it really took three people offline for about a week and a half doing interviews for that. At the end, we actually did hire a veteran for the position. So one of the things that we would feel is that kind of our organic process or having even a shorter version, we still would have been able to hire a qualified veteran for the position. The other thing I just wanted to point out is, I mean, as an employer, we've been very committed to our veterans. I told you we have almost 400 veterans working in our workforce. Our sheriff's office recently received a 2014 Air National Guard Employer of the Year. We've participated in a study for employment retention of veterans. We've got many supervisors working to get trained to help veterans be successful in our workforce. We have an active veterans employee resource group that is actually committed to helping us reach out and recruit veterans within Multnomah County. We also feel like that we have a system of qualifications where we need to make sure the qualifications that we have actually best represent and remove any barriers for individuals coming into our organization, including veterans. We're looking at right-sizing those. In essence, we think Senate Bill 87 is good because it helps clarify for us the process that we need to make sure that we follow to give preference to veterans. It ensures that qualified veterans are interviewed and given the chance to demonstrate those transferable skills, provides some assurance that the number of candidates a public employer will need to interview for the position is reasonable, describes the clear methods for us and how to apply the veterans' preference for both organizations that are large urban organizations and small rural organizations. And it maintains the multiple preferences for veterans, including the requirement to hire the veteran if all things are equal. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your support of veterans. Madam Vice Chair, any questions?
Well, I just have an issue with how can our employers know what skills are transferable, because isn't that part of, is that an easy process? It seems like it would be so subjective.
Do you want me to take
that? You're the best one. You're the chairperson.
Chair Boquist, Senator, we have a process where we're actually looking through applications. We've done a job analysis where we're actually looking at what are the actual skills we need for a position. And then we make sure that we articulate that in our recruitment announcements. We also often ask supplemental questions. And that's one way that any applicant, including a veteran, actually can lay out for us, tell us why, how you meet the qualifications, tell us why you, what skills you have on A, B, or C. So part of our process is to try to create as an objective way of measuring those transferable skills through kind of the questions, the resume, the cover letter that we might ask for, and then the information that's in the application.
Just follow up. I have found that, or I've heard, not from personal experience, but that I've heard that sometimes it's very hard for a veteran to actually communicate the skills that he has had and has had performed and would maybe be a very good match, but there's a problem with maybe communicating the skills that he does have. Is there a training for them? Is there?
Chair Boquist, Senator Montes Anderson, I'm aware of a program that is offered through the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that helps, that has a, it's a, there's a resume writing tool that helps them, helps a veteran translate their military skills into something that an employer, it's that program specific is designed for private sector employment, but I think there are services available. I would also add that there are certain things the military could do that would make it infinitely easier, which is if you have a heavy equipment operator, if they could, or a truck driver, if they could graduate with something that was equivalency, or a straight up CDL, commercial driver's license, or if medics training would come out with a EMT certification, because if a position requires certain licenses, that would be helpful. I understand the military would like to keep a hold of their folks, but realistically, that's not going to happen in all cases, and so strategizing on the transition as soon as during the training would be helpful as well.
Director? Chair Boquist, Senator Montes Anderson. I think we've seen that challenge, whether translating skills into education credits in terms of community colleges, universities, whether into the licensing boards and commissions that we have at the state level for different professions as folks transition, and also that challenge that individual veterans have translating those skills into employment. And right now, in order to get that, you know, the minimum qualifications and the special qualifications, but also the veteran has to show those transferable skills. And where that is a challenge, it washes them out from that interview. What's nice about this in terms of Senate Bill 87 is that you would still have those top five veterans interviewed with another shot in person to be able to explain those transition skills. Some other efforts across the military department's reintegration team, the employment department has a specific focus on disabled veteran outreach program. A few targeted ways that we do try to help veterans translate those skills before they go to either public or private employers, but we could certainly do more.
Well, that, I think that's the point that I wanted to raise, that we have all these veterans and they are supposed to go through reintegration, and if part of that reintegration would be focused on skills, that would help them.
And Chair Boquist, Senator Montes Anderson, about 10% of the folks serving U.S. service members in Afghanistan right now are Oregon National Guard. And you'll see a very focused effort across state agencies and local partners and others like the Chamber, both to get them on track going back to school, but also helping translate their skills back into civilian employment. Senator Olson?
I'm long out of the military. I mean, real long, and I won't tell you how long, but it's been a long time. We still have the MOS program, right? You're still defined by what your MOS is?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, yes, everyone has
And I ask that
MOS.
Out of sheer ignorance, because I was a 95 B-40. I was a military policeman. Do they not define what the educational criteria is in military police or in diesel mechanic? So can't you just quantify, say this whatever the MOS for a diesel mechanic is, can't you just quantify this and say this is what a diesel mechanic was taught, and hand that to the city and say this is what a diesel mechanic was taught, and have that qualify? And I can understand certificates, but I can also understand the broad training that I received as a military policeman.
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, members of the committee, where there has been some level of national certification is where that often works the best in terms of something that both community colleges and other training and apprenticeship programs are training to the same standard that the military is then training to, but not always a direct link in terms of what the military is training to what would be trained to on the private side.
Follow up,
please.
I'm not quite certain that I grasp what you just said, because, I mean, the training the military gets, other than the fact that if you're infantry, which is they teach you how to run a shovel to dig a ditch so you can hide, most of the standard stuff, like if you go in and you become a nurse, that nurse training is compatible to what you have on the outside. If you go through doctors or whatever, it's compatible on the outside. So I'm just wondering why we can't have a flow chart of what our people are taught, so that the city and the counties and everybody can look at the flow chart and say, this is what they learned. This fits into our thing, instead of putting the onus on the serviceman to say, I was in the military for 9 years. What did I learn when I went through my basic training, my advanced individual training, and any other courses I had? I can fix a tank. I can fix I said a deuce and a half one day, and everybody asked me what a deuce and a half was. I can fix a truck, or I can fix a Humvee. It's kind of hard for me to not understand how we can't see what these guys can do.
Did they have horses and carriages in the area?
No, they didn't. But they did have the horse-drawn cannons.
Recording question?
Anybody can respond to that? It wasn't much of a question. It was just kind of, I'm befuddled.
I think the first person is actually not one of the three of these.
Well, I looked, for example, like Portland. You said you really like veterans, but you're only at 6% of your overall workforce is veterans. To me, really liking veterans would be about 15 to 20%. That would really be liking veterans. And you said that it's a long process for you to interview 34 veterans and 34 non-veterans, et cetera, et cetera. I just see that as part of your business. You have to get the best qualified, but a veteran has some experience that other people might not have.
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, I would happily throw my fellow state agencies and the cities and counties under the bus to interview as many veterans as I thought would be helpful. But from a veteran-centric perspective, interviewing sometimes a vast range of veterans that are simply minimally qualified for the position seems like it's just a bureaucratic check-the-box process, vice truly balancing what is a meaningful preference, whether through a scored or the interview process, with what is a very the interest of public employers to have a merit-based competitive process to hire. And it doesn't make me nervous. Our veterans are going to thrive in that merit-based competitive process. There's no need for any artificial propping up. It is a challenge to translate those skills, and given the opportunity, both with some resources of support going into it and also being able to make those in an interview scenario, would go a long way to making sure they are considering that service.
Well, please. I appreciate what you said, but I can understand that. I mean, if a guy's out there and he's got military police training and you need somebody that can run heavy equipment, I can understand that you would preclude him from the process right away because he doesn't have the necessary experience. But if there is a candidate that has the necessary experience that's run heavy equipment in the military, he should at least get a look-see from the state side. And the other side of the point is that if we could define his MOS and have that be part of the criteria and show what he was trained throughout his course of being in the military, it would make it much easier for you guys doing the employment process. And if that's not available, you're relying on this person to give you what he has learned. He might be the greatest CAT operator in the world, but can he explain that to you that he is? But if you can look down and see the credentials that he's earned through the military, it makes it easier, puts him at ease, and saying, we understand that you can run all of this stuff. This is what we need. That's what I'm just trying to get to.
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, I think for where there has been that opportunity on specific MOSs, there's been a lot of progress in making those links, but still a lot of military specialties that wouldn't have a direct correlation, whether from the military education or experience, into some of the preferred qualifications that are often asked for. not a direct link that you could always see on some of those combat arms specifically. Where it makes sense in terms of police, fire, nurse, EMTs, the commercial driver's licenses. We've made great strides on those fronts, but still a lot of gray areas.
Well, it's true, but the military was not designed to put out policemen and firemen and heavy equipment operators. They're designed for another purpose, and that's to take stuff down and make a mess of everything. And that really doesn't translate into what we do in regular life. But on the other side of the coin, these guys are they learn a lot. They learn a lot from what they do. And a lot of these enterprises can be transferred, and you can give them that credit for that stuff if we can figure out how to do it.
We're going to go on. Thank you, gentlemen. Next panel is Commissioner Farr, Commissioner Hall, and Ms. Skillman. And just while they're going, I would just, for the record, say, you know, anybody that's in the combat arms obviously is qualified to be a janitor, because as the good senator said, we're cleaning up messes constantly. Skillman, I'm going to let you go last. Commissioners, fight amongst yourselves.
I was just going to pick apart what she said. But Mr. Chair, to the committee, Commissioner Pat Farr, Lane County, former U.S. Army, served in the Oregon National Guard, 162nd Infantry. When I was first in the Army, I was a 12 Charlie, which was a bridge builder. We didn't just take things apart, we built bridges. Then I became 11 Bravo Infantry, which we did a lot more than run shovels. We're here to testify on Senate Bill 87. Senate Bill 87 is a preferential interviewing and hiring for veterans. To me, this is a part of a multifaceted approach. What's important to me, Mr. Chair, and to the committee, is that we take care of our veterans. You know, when I was in the Army, and when I was in the Oregon Army National Guard, where I served in the 162nd Infantry, which is now in Afghanistan, doing rearguard action, they served in Q8. They also served in Afghanistan, in Iraq and Afghanistan. We were peacetime. It was during what was called Cold War. And not long after that, I served in this House as a representative, and I served alongside Senator Courtney I was blessed that I was in peacetime. Senator Boquist, you and I stood on the steps of the Capitol just before you were deployed, and we talked about you were saying that I think I'm going in about 3 weeks, and I said that doesn't seem possible, but it was possible. It did happen, and you went and you came home. Now, what's happening today is particularly with the Oregon Army National Guard, who have been deployed many times overseas, they're coming back and they've either lost their jobs, they've lost their housing, they've lost sometimes their family, and to me, it's important that we return them to a productive and satisfying lifestyle as soon as they get back. This bill is a part of the multifaceted approach. I'm very much involved in veterans housing. We have Operation 365 in Lane County, which is designed to make certain that by November of this year, we have zero homeless veterans in Lane County. Well, veterans also need jobs. And a part of Senate Bill 87 is making certain that that veterans, whatever their MOS may have been, whether it's 13 Charlie, 11 Bravo, whatever it may be, they are able to get that first interview realistically and have a chance to articulate what their skills were and to match their skills not only with what is listed on their basic training papers, whatever it may be, but to actually articulate the things that they did. Now, if you think about the infantry, certainly we dug foxholes, and if we had more time, you know what we did? We dug our foxholes deeper, and that's basically what we did. But in the meantime, there were many other skills that are being learned by the military, things that don't show up on your MOS sheet, things that don't show up on your AIT sheet, things that can be articulated in that first interview. Now, by choosing five veterans to interview from the long list, it's going to make it easier on HR professionals. That's not what this is all about. This is all about making it easier on veterans and making it so that veterans have a realistic chance of getting the job they're being interviewed for. To me, whether the number's five, Senator Boquist, or whether it's seven, nine, ten, whatever the number may be, giving a realistic number so that when a veteran does prepare themselves for his or her interview, they have a chance to articulate what their skills are and how they can translate what they have learned in the military to making the company that they're going to work for or the public agency that they're going to work for better, which veterans have the chance of doing that. It's absolutely important that we put veterans back into civilization. We have National Guardsmen and women coming home right now who really have difficulty adjusting after having served one or two or three or sometimes four tours of duty. So this is a part of a multifaceted approach. You'll hear more details about what the bill actually covers and some of the words. Ms. Stillen will give you some of the actual preparation of the bill. I won't go into that, and I won't go into the HR side of it. Let's just give veterans an opportunity to realistically sit in front of a prospective employee, tell them why they should be hired for that job, and then give them the best chance to get that job. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, I am Bill Hall. I'm in my 11th year as a Lincoln County Commissioner. I have been our liaison to the Veterans Service Office in the county the entire time. I'm on AOC's Veterans Committee, have just applied for membership on NACO's Veterans Committee. I am not a veteran myself, but I am the son and grandson of U.S. Marine combat veterans. And I am also here to support Senate Bill 87 as filed, because I strongly believe that it will provide a meaningful way to strengthen the veterans' preference law. You know, I think just one line from the bill provides the essence of why it is needed. In Section 1E, it is not beneficial to a veteran to be granted an interview if the veteran is not relatively competitive with other applicants. Because I can tell you from my own experience with various local government agencies, I know of several cases where this exact scenario has played out, where candidates who just barely meet the minimum threshold in experience or education, but do not rise to the level of the most competitive applicants are interviewed. Everybody involved seems to feel terrible about it, feels it's a waste of their time, but more importantly, a waste of the veterans' time. And I think this bill provides a reasonable fix. I know it is the product of a work group that had wide participation, a work group that was created at your request, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to encourage the committee to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Skillman, you're finally here for the summary, but since this committee is the same committee that heard the first bill around, we're pretty educated on this topic. So,
great. Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Monis Anderson, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laurie Skillman. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I sat on the stakeholder work group that created Senate Bill 97 at the request of the House Veterans Committee and the Senate Veterans Committee from a year ago. As you know, I think you are all aware of all of the members of the committee from Department of Administrative Services, ODVA, OMD, League of Oregon Cities, Association of Oregon Counties, and others. And the group worked very hard to craft a bill that created some clarity in the statute around veterans' preference. Before I go any further, I'd like to address Senator Olson's question about transferable skills and being able to decode those transferable skills. A couple of things. There are a number of fabulous online programs that are free where veterans can go in, put in their MOS, and it will tell them exactly how to translate those transferable skills. They can use that when they apply for a position and describe that in civilian terms. The other thing is the Employment Department, through the Federal Department of Labor, has a group of veterans who work with veterans and disabled veterans on just this thing, translating your military skills and your education. And the current statute puts the burden on the veteran to describe those transferable skills. So the 13-member stakeholder work group was formed. They worked from April to November, created Senate Bill 87. They developed language, definitions, and methods that can be universally understood and implemented by all public employers. I think one of the things that we found out when we started meeting together, that everyone was using different language to describe the same thing. So we created a universal language that all public employers could know and understand, and created definitions around that. The most important voices in that stakeholder work group were the five people who were veterans or had served in the military. Probably one key part of the bill, as Commissioner Hall mentioned, is this very first section. And the very first section, unlike many statutes, defines the legislative intent. The legislative intent in veterans' preference has been a real struggle for employers all over the state. What was the intent of the legislation? And so Section 1 lays out findings and then intent. This may be unusual, but it will resolve a lot of issues and a lot of litigation. The existing statutes right now, as I've testified before, are unclear, confusing, and provide no real guidance on implementing for public employers. One of the things that, since I've been at ODVA, is I've learned to look at things from what we call at the department, looking at things through the veteran's lens. So I'm going to describe Senate Bill 87 through the lens of a veteran. What's in it for the veteran? What's in Senate Bill 87 for the veteran? First, it's beneficial because veterans' rights and benefits are clear and easy to understand. A veteran can read and understand what the veteran's preference means, how it's going to be applied to them, and they'll know what processes the employer is going to use. And currently, it's clear unclear and confusing. A veteran doesn't know what it means and doesn't know how an employer is going to apply it. The second benefit to veterans is that it holds employers accountable and requires public employers to follow a prescribed selection process for applying veterans' preference. Current statute is real unclear. It says, an employer shall devise and apply methods by which the employer gives special consideration in the employer's hiring process. In Senate Bill 87, those methods are real clear and prescribed. Everyone's going to know whether an employer applied veterans' preference correctly or didn't. So in that way, it really holds the employer's feet to the fire and makes it real simple for a veteran to know what it is their rights are. The third thing that you've heard several times is that the bill provides fair and meaningful preference to a veteran at every key stage in the hiring process. The key stages are the evaluation stage, the interview stage, and the final selection process. That's where veterans' preference is applied. It's real clear when it needs to be applied and how you do that. It moves veterans ahead of non-veterans, and disabled veterans are given a greater preference. Current law doesn't say when and how preference should be applied. The fourth thing is it requires employers to give more defined opportunities for qualified than competitive veterans to have an initial interview. You've heard about the requirement that there are five veterans, sort of regardless of your selection pool, you must interview the top five veteran candidates. You can interview more than that, but that's kind of a minimum threshold. If you interviewed 20 to 25 candidates for your first round of interviews, which according to the HR people I talked to, is a significant group, 20 to 25 for the first round interviews, then veterans would make up 20 to 25% of that interview group. One of the things is that it reinforces, the other thing that it does, it reinforces the purpose and intent of 3207, which is the interview bill. The current law requires employers to interview only veterans who've submitted applications that show evidence that the veteran has transferable skills. The onus is on the veteran for transferable skills. And the fifth one is that it's clear that an employer is required to give a veteran greater preference than a non-veteran at the final selection process. So if you have a veteran and a non-veteran, and they are equal candidates, you must hire the veteran. If you have a disabled veteran, that person gets even greater preference. So there are some benefits to the public and employers who must implement the statute. It provides clear and straightforward methods to apply veterans' preference that an employer can understand and implement. And the second and most important is that the legislative intent is clear. Senate Bill 87 benefits veterans, the public, and public employers. It's a carefully constructed and consensus-driven bill that provides fair and meaningful preference to veterans, provides clarity, and holds employers accountable for applying preference within strict parameters. And at the end of my testimony, I have the methods for applying veterans' preference that I went over in December. And those two processes were the scored method and an interview method, and when veterans' preference is applied at each stage. So happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Rabbi Sher.
No, just really glad that the work group came out with a good product.
Can't see it in there. Senator Olson, any questions?
No.
Senator Courtney?
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Ms. Sparks, Mr. Stuckey, and is there anybody else that wants to testify? You don't look like Mr. Stuckey, so Sean, he must have left, right? I was going to say, Dave, you've gained a lot of weight. And you've grown about 4 inches. Ladies first.
Okay. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, here to support the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 87. As you know, the Bureau enforces anti-discrimination laws in housing, public accommodation, and employment. Our protection for employment also includes the veterans' preference right now. We were asked to lead the work group. The work group formed a subgroup to work on some definition issues, some other policy perspectives. We have significant agreement on lots of sort of some of the definition fixes, but it began to veer farther away from what we interpreted as the benefit to veterans. We interpret the current law to mean that all qualified veterans should be interviewed and that the preference should apply throughout the hiring process. It's because at an initial interview stage, you could get something that was not a true interview, could be a pro forma. So as an agency dedicated to protecting veterans, the existing rights of veterans, it is our belief that this law should not be scaled back to change either existing protection. There's room for compromise, which is why we've proposed the Dash 1 amendment, which would change the definition to mean that every qualified veteran would mean that you meet the minimum requested and required skills of the public employer, but a veteran who meets those limits would have to be interviewed under the current law. Boley opposes any efforts to weaken the current law to take away current rights that veterans have. Happy to answer any questions.
Mr. McCormick.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I'm Sean McCormick. I'm a policy advisor with the Oregon Military Department. And the Military Department was a member of the task force that developed Senate Bill 87, and we're here today in support of that legislation. We believe the bill simplifies and clarifies how veterans' preference points should be applied. And as a military organization, we very much understand, appreciate, and promote the skills and abilities that veterans bring to the table. And we encourage any organization, not just public sector, but private sector as well, to consider hiring a veteran whenever possible. So in conclusion, we do support Senate Bill 87 and we do hope you pass it. Thank you.
You're on.
My name is Michael Sellers. I'm currently employed as Chief of Staff for State Senator Herman Bertschinger. I was briefly involved in the committee or the work group, and at the beginning, as Ms. Sparks mentioned, it became a subgroup, and I hadn't originally intended to testify, but I have a significant amount of experience in this area, and I thought it would be important for the committee to consider some brief remarks. The challenge that I see as from a personal perspective, from a veteran perspective, is that it feels like this legislation is trying to do the human resources director's job for them. From the perspective of looking for cover rather than a way to help veterans. And I'm concerned about that. As a veteran and a Oregonian, I'm concerned that we're not doing the right, this is not the right step to help Oregonians and Oregon veterans obtain public employment. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, and thank you for your service. Madam Vice Chair, questions?
I would like to know what the Dash 1 amendments do. I can read it, but I'd rather have you tell me what it does.
Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Montes Anderson, the Dash 1 amendment tightens up on what it means to be a qualified veteran. So the veteran would meet, current law says that the veteran must meet just minimum qualifications to qualify for the veteran's preference. This would say that a veteran has to meet the minimum requested and required skills that an employer requires for a position before they would be eligible for the preference.
Commissioner Olson?
Michael, thank you for your service, but what would you do to correct this, to fix this? What would be your fix for this?
That's a good question, sir. Senator Boquist, Senator Olson, that's a good question. I think that the stakeholder group should be identified more properly. I don't think, as important as it is to create clarity in the statute, I think that having a significant representation of members of the Veterans Committee or community would be more important rather than, I understand that the onus of this legislation is to clarify for public employers what they're supposed to do. I think it's challenging that the bulk of the stakeholders were public employers rather than members of the Veterans community. So I don't have an answer for you, sir.
Okay, thank you very much. This topic is going to come back. I would point out I've asked some of the commissioners to have a discussion with the other commissioner and see what sort of common ground and so everybody has clarity with this. This bill will be coming back in one fashion or the other since the legislature didn't provide the right clarity 4 years ago. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 87. I'm going to open a public hearing on SB 235. Sean, I believe you're back up again. Go ahead. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 235 changes names of Oregon's Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund and Disaster Response Fund to the Emergency Preparedness Account and the Disaster Response Account, respectively, relocates both funds within the general fund from their current source of federal funds, changes the name of the local disaster account loan and grant account in the Oregon Disaster Response Fund to the local disaster assistance loan and grant subaccount within the Oregon Disaster Response Account, changes deposit of interest on repayment of principal on loans into renamed subaccount instead of into the general fund, declares an emergency is effective on passage. Again, because your membership hasn't changed, Mr. Chair, you'll recognize this measure from previous attempts to change some of the accounting structures to help with OMD's flexibility in its budget.
Right, Sean, less is more, and if you don't screw it up, we'll schedule it for a work session next week.
Very good, Chair Boquist. Members of the committee, I'm Sean McCormick. I'm a policy advisor with the Oregon Military Department. And yes, we have been before you before on this topic. I'm here to discuss Senate Bill 235 and its impact on OEM. We're going to very briefly discuss some legislative history. We're going to discuss the changes made by 235, the staff impacts, and some general fund discussion on the potential kicker implications. So the Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund and the Disaster Response Fund were created by the 2008 legislature in the aftermath of a winter storm to ensure that they could identify the difference between mitigation expenses and disaster response expenses. But there was an unintended consequence by creating the funds as separate and distinct from the general fund, and that has impacted our ability to process some of our day-to-day operational expenses. So to correct that issue, we brought forth legislation in 2010, 11, 13, and now 15 to hopefully rectify that that situation. So the changes made by Senate Bill 235 are really quite simple and straightforward. We're looking to change the name of the Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund to the Emergency Preparedness Account. That will help us facilitate a request made by FEMA in 2008. We'd like to change the Disaster Response Fund to the Disaster Response Account, the Disaster Loan and Grant Account to a sub-account, and have the accounts established as within the general fund as opposed to separate and distinct from the general fund. The impact that is currently in place for OEM fiscal staff is we're not able to utilize a tool known as linking allotment, which is a cash flow tool. Linking allotment allows a state agency to temporarily borrow already appropriated general fund to cover the cost of a bill until federal revenue is received. But you have to have your accounts or your funds established within the general fund to have that tool available to you, and these two funds are not. So we have to utilize clearing accounts to cover our payroll costs and our operational S&S costs. So an expense is incurred in a clearing account, a federal fund revenue is drawn into one of the two funds, and then the expense has to be manually moved from the clearing account into the corresponding fund so that revenues and expenses match. This has increased our risk of transactions. We have also had to put into place a new reconciliation process. It's increased the complexity of our audit trail, and it's a highly inefficient process, which this next chart will show. The blue columns represent transaction counts, and the red line indicates staff hours. So far this biennium, through the end of December, we've had to do 10,000 plus entries at almost 1,400 staff hours at a cost of nearly $63,000, almost 100% of which has been billed to the federal government. So should Senate Bill 235 be passed, the blue columns go away, and the staff time transitions to providing customer service and technical assistance to our county partners, our city partners, our tribal partners, state agency partners, and federal partners as it relates to a wide spectrum of federal grants. And it also allows some very talented fiscal staff to focus on improving other processes inside of OEM. So the reason why this issue has not been rectified is there's still some concern about potential implications to the state kicker. So we've had to have the conversation about the difference between legal general fund and the appropriated general fund. The legal general fund refers to a Treasury Fund 0401. I won't bore you with all the details about it, but it's a big pot of money. Other funds, lottery funds, federal funds. But the monies in that fund consist of really two different categories. The first are funds like personal and corporate income tax that do not have a dedicated or specific purpose. They're available for general governmental use. They're known as the appropriated fund, appropriated general fund, and they are the funds that are forecasted for the kicker under ORS 291-348 and 291-349. The second category are monies that do have a statutorily specified and dedicated purpose and are unavailable for general governmental purposes. And it's that distinction, unavailable for general governmental purposes, that excludes them, to our understanding, from the kicker calculation. So Senate Bill 235 would move the Emergency Preparedness Account and the Disaster Response Account to within the legal general fund, but it would not make them relevant to the appropriated general fund. All the monies in the funds, or accounts as we were hoping they'll be called, are still continuously appropriated to the military department for a dedicated and specific purpose. And it's due to that dedicated and specific nature that the monies would not be included in the kicker calculation. So what I've just talked to you about was the result. Yes.
And how much money are we talking?
Chair Boquist, Senator Montes Anderson, the transactions that we're talking about that will be impacted by this legislation are about $200,000 a month. But the total value of the grants that flow through these two funds, dating back to the inception in 2008, 34 grants, face value about $197 million. So What we've been talking about is based on conversations that we've had with the Treasurer's Office. They submitted a letter to us indicating that Senate Bill 235 will have no impact to the state kicker, basically recycling language that they've provided on our behalf dating back to 2011. We've also discussed this topic at length with the Chief Financial Office, and they also share in our opinion that there is no impact to the state kicker as a result of Senate Bill 235. So again, we're hoping to have the Pre-Disaster Mitigation Fund changed to the emergency preparedness account, the disaster response fund changed to the disaster response account, and the loan and grant account changed to a subaccount, have the accounts established within the general fund, and that will allow us to streamline our accounting functions and get rid of this inefficient duplicative process. And I want to take this opportunity to unequivocally state that Senate Bill 235 will in no way impact our ability to distinguish the difference between mitigation expenses and disaster response expenses. And that was the underlying goal from the 2008 legislature in the first place. And that concludes my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's also of note that there is not currently a subsequent referral on Senate Bill 235, but it has previously generated one to Ways and Means, and so you might anticipate that that would happen again with this measure this time.
Madam Vice Chair.
Nothing. Thank you.
Just for the record, we've been cleaning this up for about 6 years now. This is like the third session we've gone through with the same topic, just a different account, cleaning it up. Any questions? With that, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 235, and it'll be scheduled for work session next week. I'd open a public hearing on SB 250. Council, if you would, please, because I don't think there's anybody here to testify.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 250 permits rather than requires the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to provide beneficiaries with financial assistance for education. It adds the location of World War II memorial into the statutory language. It modifies the definition of disabled veterans for consistency. It repeals outdated statutes referencing World War II Memorial Task Force, which no longer exists now that the memorial is installed. Some business repair loan program language, campus veteran service officers program rules language, possibility of a federal veterans home language, and reference to county poorhouses. It declares an emergency is effective on passage. And I believe there is written testimony that was submitted from ODVA on the cleanup nature of, housekeeping nature of this measure that's available on OLIS.
Anybody want to testify? Move quickly. Ms. Skillman, again.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laurie Skillman with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. We went through the statutes in 406, 7, and 8, which the agency has jurisdiction over, and just did a housekeeping bill to repeal archaic statutes. I mean, the reference to county poorhouses, last county poorhouse was here in 1950, so that statute, 65 years archaic. And it repeals statutes where the agency was required to do something but hasn't been funded for in at least 5 years. So it's really a housekeeping kind of bill to clean statutes out that don't apply anymore.
Questions? And Vice Chair.
It's a short.
Senator Olson, please.
Go ahead.
Before you do.
No, I think it's a short bill. and you're saying it does a lot.
Well, it repeals.
It repeals
five statutes.
406, 407, I gotcha. Okay.
Yes, you don't see.
Right.
Yes.
Only a statement when you said over 65 years is archaic. My bones shook a little bit.
Oh, excuse me.
Yeah.
In statutory terms, sir.
Okay, if there are no further questions, then we're going to close the public hearing on SB 250, and it'll be placed on the calendar for work session next week. Open our final hearing, which is SB 97. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 97 was previously heard on March the 10th, and there were some questions from the committee that might have been appropriate for Department of Human Services and or Oregon Health Authority. They were both invited. And the gentleman from the Health Authority, I believe, is here, but DHS declined. It requires the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority to reinstate home and community-based services for eligible children temporarily removed from the state due to a parent's military service, as specified in the bill.
Anna Lansky, is that who's coming up?
Sorry about that.
Okay, somebody coming?
Mr. Chair and committee, for the record, my name is Mark Sansusi, the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for the Northwest. I was here last week, and I'm not going to, you don't want to hear me testify again, but I just have one anecdote. Since last week, I drove my 200 miles back up the road to go home and got a phone call from a woman in Virginia. She is a military spouse of an Oregonian who's an attorney in Virginia in a Naval Reserve assignment, has a developmental disabled child, and is watching this as we speak, is following legislation on this. She asked me what she could do to help the most, and I said, please write to Chair Boquist. She happens to be a constituent of Chair Boquist and lives in that district, and they consider themselves Oregonians who are coming home maybe within another year or so. So they're very in favor of this. She wrote to Chair Boquist and CC'd all of you, and I totally understand you have lots of emails. So it just goes to show that there are people out there who are watching and stand to benefit from coming back as Oregonians and not having to go through the whole process all over again to get that Medicaid waiver help. With that, I stand for any questions.
Ladies.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Anna Lansky. I'm a Deputy Director for Office of Developmental Disability Services.
Chair Boquist, committee members, my name is Acacia McGuire Anderson. I'm the Field Unit Manager for the Department of Developmental Disability Services.
Thank you.
This is Anna Lansky. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify this afternoon on the Senate Bill 97. The department is neutral on this legislature. We are here to request for some guidance on a couple of items in this legislature and also answer any questions that the committee may have. The first item that we would like to have some guidance from the committee for future rulemaking purposes is the definition of the temporary absence. It would be helpful for future rulemaking to know specifically what is meant by the temporary, what specific duration is implied by that term. The second item that we would like to have some clarification on is the definition of immediate reinstatement. There are obviously the department as well as its provider network work very hard to make sure that individuals receive services as quickly as possible. However, there are certain circumstances that may impact those timelines. For example, the needs or the circumstances of the child may change over time, and therefore the former service arrangements may no longer be appropriate or adequate for the individual, and therefore additional planning may need to take place to make sure that the services meet the needs of the child. Also, the former provider support or former service arrangements may no longer be available. For example, if in the past the child has been receiving services in the group home, that particular vacancy may no longer be available or taken by somebody else. Also, the former service arrangements may no longer be the choice of the family, and they may want to receive the services in a different form or fashion. If the absence is, in fact, very extended, then the federal mandates require the department to also redetermine eligibility, which ultimately impacts the ability of the department to draw federal matching funds for the provision of the services. However, the department is confident that with further guidance from this committee, we'll be able to address these issues through a rulemaking process, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Before we go to questions, because this is, just so you know, you didn't get it, Karina, this is model legislation from the Department of Defense, who obviously coordinated with their federal peers above us over on the CMMS side and those sorts of things. So, Mr. Sansusi, you heard the two questions.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Obviously in the other 49 states.
thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for letting me. On the first one, on temporary, five states have passed this bill into law since we started working this last year, and none of the other states have set any defined term limit for the term temporary. That does not mean that we wouldn't be amenable if somebody were to say 5 years, because just thinking about the military family that moves at least once before they come back. But obviously we haven't striven for set times, because someone could come back 2 years from now or retire coming back here in 18. So we left it at the way it was, and no other state has changed it. But we're willing to go with your better judgment on that one. As far as the immediate reinstatement point that Anna made, We're not hard over on that. It sounds to me like there are extenuating circumstances where we reasonable extenuating circumstances, given the varying circumstances in this world, that certainly we can live with any kind of amending language that they or that you prefer to have to clarify and meet the rulemaker's needs. So,
okay, Madam Vice Chair, you're the expert on this particular category. What do we do elsewhere?
Well, I think the intent of the bill was to make sure that they didn't have to go through this laborious process to be reinstated. Now, I'm not familiar with, you know, temporary absence. I mean, it could be 18 years, it could be 5 years. What is reasonable? I mean, we would definitely need to have redetermine eligibility after 18 years. There's no question, but...
And Madam Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, we agree. Over time, there are acute conditions and all types of things that can happen with the physical condition of a developmental disabled dependent. So we're not unreasonable about that. It's just no other state has striven so far. And I have a bill that just passed the Montana Senate that does not also have a definition of temporary. The word that's you guys can break ground if you decide you'd like to set a set standard. Okay with that.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yeah, well, to me, I would think that even after 2 years or 4 years, they could be reinstated. There should be a short way of still redetermining if they're eligible, but not having to go through everything. I think that was the intent.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Senator Moss Anderson, the example from last week, as an example, having a Down syndrome child, condition's not really going to, hasn't really changed much, and that family had to come back to Washington State and prove that all over again, and as she said, picking the scab all over again, and that's
what
again,
we want to avoid.
Intent.
Yeah.
My observation is, I'm looking to the back of the room here. I mean, we're talking 4 or 5 years here. I mean, the normal maximum, I think Marine Corps does a 3-year enlistment tour. Most the rest of the services do a 4-year enlistment tour. And if so, if the magic number is, say, 5 years, as Mr. Sansui said, you're going to be on the beyond the first enlistment or mobilization short of World War III, covering about 90% of what we're trying to cover here. Am I correct here? Does that sound, Mr. Sansui? I mean,
Mr. Chair, yes.
And I'm looking back at the ODD
Yes, Mr.
Director.
Chair. That sounds reasonable to me. Yes, sir.
Right. And then the other issue is, you know, the definition, I suppose, of immediate reinstatement mm-hmm. along that line. And I would ask if the department is willing and Mr. Sansusi is willing to compare notes and bring us, you know, just short, give to counsel who are short intent here that we either plug in as an amendment to the bill or something that we can put into the record so we can identify, you know, that temporary absence if it's 4 or 5 years. I would think 5 years is a magic number simply because you're beyond the typical enlistment, and after that you're in a career pattern and you're there for 20 some years or for World War III. And then the other one is how we kind of, you know, what does, and this is well out of my bailiwick, immediate reinstatement, how they do that. And you might want to, obviously, I believe, according to testimony previously, you weren't here, Ms. Lansky, is we've done this in some other arenas already in the present.
For instance, in the jail system, they are Medicaid eligible when they go into the corrections system. But then as soon as they get into the corrections system, they lose their Medicaid eligibility. We passed legislation that would prevent that so that they could that their eligibility is suspended. I mean, their active participation is suspended, but then it is renewed once they are not they need medical care or they're not in the corrections system.
Could you let the man behind you take your seat? Oh. He may have an answer to that question. No, Anna, you need to stay there because you're talking.
Oh.
Come back up, Anna.
You got an answer to that question? Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, Brian Ebert, legislative coordinator for health care programs at the Oregon Health Authority. I just want to clarify, I think what our two related but different conversations. When it comes to what's being done with the incarcerated population that we've been working on for the last several years, that has to do with their Medicaid enrollment eligibility. And because federal law does not allow for federal funds to be used except under a very limited set of circumstances for people that are incarcerated for Medicaid reimbursement, we had previously been terminating those benefits, and now we are long underway with suspending those benefits that would allow for them to be reinstated upon release from a correctional facility. In the case of families, and especially children, as I understand this bill, that are Medicaid enrolled and go out of state, unless we are given indication that they are affirmatively changing their address to a different state, there is nothing done to those benefits. They still need to meet the there still is a federal requirement that they have an annual redetermination of those benefits, but we do not do anything. They're completely left open. So I just want to clarify that point, that what we're doing on the suspension and with incarcerated individuals is separate from what would impact military families.
So what you want to do is stay out of this fight, right?
What's that?
You want to stay out of this fight, right? That's what you're saying?
We want to provide information, Chair Boquist.
Okay.
What I see is that we suspended their eligibility. And this is what I see. When they move out, we suspend, but we don't terminate their eligibility if they're in the military.
Chair Boquist, Senator Bonas Anderson, we don't even suspend. They remain active beneficiaries as long as they're maintaining in our system an indication that their permanent address and where they intend to return is in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Ansuri?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monis Anderson and I guess Brian, if they're in Virginia serving, they're not receiving a Medicaid waiver under Oregon law while they're living in Virginia, are they? And that's the point of the Medicare waiver, is to get the benefit for those things that are not covered by TRICARE ECHO. And so I'm confused by that, because I doubt that they're getting Medicaid waivers while living in Virginia when they're Oregonians. So is that, yes.
Okay, Ms. Lansky, jump in.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in general, the Medicaid rules do not allow the person to be determined eligible for Medicaid in two different states. The person needs to be eligible within the states of their primary residency. And so that would basically generally be a guiding principle. And also to provide a little bit of information that might be helpful, generally for us to reopen a case for an individual who's been absent for less than a year is very easy. You just reopen the eligibility. However, we are mandated by federal rules to determine certain eligibility requirements every year, and that's something we may not necessarily be able to waive without ability, you know, also waiving the ability to draw federal matching funds for these services.
Okay, so Ms. Lansky, you're going to get together with Mr. Sansui, because at the federal level, the two of them are talking and going down this road. So there's a mechanism to do this done. I think the temporary guidance that I've heard here is the normal enlistment's 4 years, so by the time they get back, a 5 year is kind of the temporary deal, and then what immediate reinstatement really means for guidance for you folks. I would ask that you get together and get back with us, because we're going to put it on the schedule for a work session 2 weeks from today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, other questions? Okay, colleagues, we're going to close the public hearing. Is there anybody else that wants to testify on this? Nobody jumping. Close the public hearing on SB 97. Colleagues, we're done for the day. Next week, same time, same place.
Why did you have no notice? Why did you have no notice?